Good evening. This is Emily Taylor. Welcome to A Feminist Perspective. This weekly radio broadcast is sponsored by the Women's Research and Career Planning Center, a program and information service of the Dean of Women's Office, 220 Strong Hall. A Feminist Perspective provides a forum for women themselves to speak publicly on issues of concern to them and help inform other women and men of the movement which is remaking the shape and substance of women's and men's lives throughout the world. The Women's Resource and Career Planning Center contains large amounts of information, news clippings, government documents, magazine articles, research studies, and books pertaining to the many aspects of the women's movement. We should like to invite you to come in to browse or take advantage of the materials which can be borrowed. That's in 220 Strong Hall at the University of Kansas. The subject of tonight's broadcast is affirmative action. We've had other programs on this subject, but not for some time. We have with us tonight a representative from the Affirmative Action Office, Vicki Hamer, who is a graduate research assistant in the office. Shirley Gillum is the Affirmative Action Officer. Edith Black, the chairperson for the Affirmative Action Board. And two representatives of Affirmative Action Committees at the university. Dr. Paul Hack, who is the chairperson for the Research and Graduate Studies Affirmative Action Committee. And Dr. Diane Kelly from the Student Affairs Committee. I think we might start, folks, by talking a little about how all these things fit together. We have an Affirmative Action Office, we have an Affirmative Action Board, and we have five Affirmative Action Committees. Paul, could you tell us what your understanding is of why we have the five committees in addition to the board?
Well, of course, we have various concerns and types of administrative organizations on campus. And so I believe the five committees were established in terms of administrative convenience and effectiveness in order to carry on affirmative action at the university. Our sector, as you mentioned, is concerned with research and graduate studies. And this brings together a large and somewhat diverse group of people. However, the common concern, as I say, is with research and graduate studies. We include the Anthropological Museum, Biological Survey, various bureaus such as the Bureau of Child Research. We include the Comp Center, and various museums, as well as the graduate school and graduate studies in general. And in this process, we can try to approach the affirmative action goals in ways that are at least common to the groups which we represent in research and graduate studies.
Mm-hmm. And Diane is a chairperson for the Student Affairs Committee. What does that include?
Well, we act as an advisory committee for Vice Chancellor Balfour, and some of the units that we include would be admissions, Dean of Women, Dean of Men, Counseling Center, Student Union, Continuing Education, Foreign Students. There may be some more that they're escaping me at the moment.
The hospital,
isn't it? Right, right. Union? The medical center. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned the union. Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the medical center on campus.
Mm-hmm. Watkins Hospital.
The Watkins Hospital. Mm-hmm. The others who chair committees that aren't here, the academic is pretty obvious, the various schools and departments within those schools of the university, and business, which is includes really all the business arrangements that come under Vice Chancellor Nitcher. So really the idea was to make sure that nothing got forgotten and that there was somebody who was knowledgeable about each particular aspect of the university. Now that information is all fed into the Affirmative Action Office, which is represented here tonight by Vicki Hamer. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Affirmative Action Office does?
Well, we're primarily involved with implementing executive orders issued by President Johnson early in the 60s. And we tend to serve as a kind of a coordinating point for the different committees and also for the board. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about the executive order so that you know what we're working at. The first executive order that President Johnson issued
first one really didn't include sex. It was about...
No, okay, right. The first... excuse me, I just really had a mind blank right there. The first executive order he issued regarded minorities and said that discrimination should be stopped against minorities and special efforts should be made to repair the damage that had been done. Recruitment of qualified minorities, that sort of thing. The second executive order amended the first to include sex, and the executive orders apply to institutions and businesses receiving federal money. So what we do is try to implement that executive order following a special plan that was devised by the by the Affirmative Action Board. We're involved right now in suits against the university. Would you like me to delineate those?
Actually formal charges, isn't it, with the various enforcement agents. I think we could get to that a little bit later. I have one other group represented here, the overall Affirmative Action Board, represented by the chairperson, Edith Black. Is this the second Affirmative Action Board, is it not, Edith, that the university has had?
Yes, the original board was appointed by Chancellor Chalmers and worked for over a year designing a plan that would comply with the executive order, but I think could go beyond that. I think an academic community often, or at least we would hope, would dedicate itself to the goals of affirmative action, whether there was an executive order or not. Certainly we are compelled to follow that, but I think the plan goes a little beyond that. The plan was designed and completed and then accepted as university policy, I believe, last March. So we've been, in the last, say, 9 months, engaged in the implementation in the educational phase, bringing the whole policy and the action side to the various units which these committees represent to get it closer to the people that are involved and to try to reach our goals for affirmative action.
So the second board that's appointed is implementing the plan that was made by the first board.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, we've mentioned the executive order, and of course that's the first time that the term affirmative action was used, but now of course we have quite a number of laws, and other guidelines mention affirmative action too. The three, I think, that we're most concerned about are the executive order with guidelines put out by the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, then Title VII, under which the university came last, in March of 1972, just last year, with guidelines from the put out by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and now Title IX of the Higher Education Act, or the Education Amendments of 1972, enforced by HEW, as far as the university is concerned, all of these are enforced by HEW. So we now have a whole variety of laws, all of which say we must take affirmative action. So we better make sure that everybody understands what affirmative action is. When somebody asks you that, how do any of you define it? I recall one time in the early days being at a meeting that didn't involve the University of Kansas at all, but a city group that is also required to take affirmative action, and the definitions that were given in those early days were a little bit on the funny side, to say the least. I'm not sure anybody would have gone away really knowing what it all means. What do you say when someone asks you what affirmative action is? Because this isn't going to go away, is it? In fact, it's becoming more and more important now for universities to observe. And, of course, universities aren't the only ones that are involved, but that's our particular topic. What do you say, Paul, when someone says, what is affirmative action?
Well, it certainly involves willful self-study, analysis, and then a setting of goals, plans, to rectify and equalize, normalize some situation that is not so at present.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that the idea was that discrimination, or just stopping discrimination, wasn't enough. Once you've stopped discrimination, women and minorities still aren't adequately represented in a lot of areas. So the idea of affirmative action was to improve on that, to seek out qualified women and minorities and to hire them in areas where they've been underutilized.
Both hiring, promotion, recruitment, the whole work. So those who had been previously discriminated against, that special action would have to be taken to give them an equal opportunity with those who had not been discriminated against. Would you have any other ideas on the subject of how you would define it? You know, I noticed recently in Title IX, there's reference to remedial action, which I think is a rather good idea because under affirmative action, of course, there was the obligation to correct past errors, too. If it were determined that that certain groups in the university had been underpaid, remedial action was supposed to be taken to make their pay equal to that of others on the campus. Now the term in Title IX is specifically used, remedial action and affirmative action, which means do more than would be required or more than ultimately should be done when we arrive at the place where all the remedial action has been done. In other words, if we get to the place where everyone, regardless of sex or race, every human being individually is admitted to whatever training program, medical school, law school, engineering, and so forth, in a relationship to that individual's own abilities and interests, regardless of all these other things, and we don't need affirmative action anymore, do we?
But we're a long way from getting to that. The resistance we often see is that instead of non-discrimination, now we're having reverse discrimination, and we're looking at people who are not as well qualified. You know, we get that all the time. That what we're actually into now is reverse discrimination. But your remedial point is the thrust of many of us, that it's going to take a while before we're going to be able to make up the time that's been lost by all these years of underutilization of the people that we're talking about.
Right. And I'm also pleased to see that affirmative action has grown beyond the idea of quotas, or just bare quotas, which I think really gave us a bad name to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Except that there was never any requirement for
quotas. No, but this was something in the public mind and in the press, and I think got much more play than it deserved.
Oh, yes. I noticed even a couple of weeks ago a perfectly disgraceful letter to the editor in the Chronicle of Higher Education, written by presumably by a scholar, with a real straw man technique, you know, building up a false idea of what affirmative action was in the first place and then saying why that false idea was wrong. I noticed in the last issue that there was an excellent response to him, very reasoned. There never was anything which said one should take unqualified people, was it? There never was any rule that said that there should be a specific quota. Go ahead, Diane.
Paul, I'm not sure that in the minds of many people, though, that I think in the minds of quite a number of people, affirmative action still is equated with quotas. And I think we've got a real mission ahead of us to convince people that that is not the only thrust or the thrust of it.
And I think we must understand that there's a difference between goals, which certainly we must have and we must study and we must set, and quotas.
Perhaps we should explain it.
Yeah, this would be a good time right now to start that process, isn't it, in case there's someone who still feels that that quotas and goals are the same. What do goals mean, and why is it important that we have them? Well, maybe why is it important that we have them would be a good place to start. Why can't we just say we aren't going to discriminate anymore?
Well, some ideas that kind of fall off the top of my head is that people might be a little less persuaded to really make the effort if they didn't have, a pattern or a guide to follow right in front of them. And it's important for us to also know what areas need that kind of improvement. A goal is merely a number that is set. And, well, let's say for instance, we want to try to find one woman and one minority in a given field in the next 5 years. What the department or the unit will be required to do is try to find someone who's qualified. And there we have special procedures and recruitment sources to aid them in that process. If the five-year time period ends and they haven't found someone, they're not going to be penalized in any way for not having done it, if they can demonstrate that they've made a good faith effort. If they can show us their records and they can say, we have looked everywhere we could possibly think of looking with your aid and have not found a qualified woman, then hiring a qualified man is not going to.
You're saying they won't be penalized. One of the discussions at Affirmative Action Board, and I understand in the Minority Affairs Advisory Committee also, is some kind of incentive to be provided through budgetary means for the various units who can identify qualified people. And we're very hopeful that our administration will come up with, if not our plan, something similar, to get some built-in incentives. One of two ways have been suggested. One is that we would isolate certain positions that would be filled only by those units who could identify minority. This applies more to minorities as women. That they could identify a qualified minority person for a position in their unit. They would then get that position and could not have it in their budget if they couldn't identify a minority. The other is to have a fund which could supplement a budget line that is open. The thing is said that the market for a minority PhD in most fields is beyond some of our reach. And so one of the plans is that we would have a fund in which various units could draw if they had a qualified person that they could get if they had the money in their budget. So we hope to get some incentives built in.
I think it's important to point out right now, to diverge just a little bit from that incentive program, that if a department or a unit cannot provide adequate justification for not having hired a woman or minority, then the university can be denied federal funds, which is in many cases, I know it amounts up into the millions of dollars here, and I think that's the case at most large universities. So that's the ultimate penalty.
Surely one of the concerns of our research and graduate sector committee at this moment is finding a way of demonstrating compliance and assuring compliance to HEW on the basis of non-discrimination of sex for Titles 7 and 8. This is one of the charges that the Vice Chancellor has just presented us. I assume that can we not supply satisfactory assurance of non-discrimination on the basis of sex for these programs, which involve a lot of student awards, support of students in various training programs at the graduate level, that these awards would be cut off by the federal government?
Well, let's hope so, because that's the point of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I want to go back just a little bit to goals and timetables, because your example may have been a little extreme, like one person in the next five years. Let's take a more simple example than that. A large department. one of our largest departments, I suppose, is English, isn't it?
That's our largest.
Now, it has a certain number of professional faculty in it. I don't know how many, let's say 50. Maybe twice as many or half that many, I don't know what. Now, how do you determine how many? You've used the word qualified, and of course when we use that, we must use it in front of all people, men as well as women, minority or majority. So let's just drop it and say people who have the proper credentials to teach in the English department. How do you determine what the goal should be for a department?
Do you want me to answer?
Yeah, why don't you, since you've gone through those figures?
Quite a bit. Well, the number of women and minorities in, let's just say, the faculty is determined, and the percentage of the total faculty is determined of women, men, and each of the significant minorities that we are dealing with.
That is what exists right now is first determined, right?
Right, that's determined. Mm-hmm. Then that percentage is compared to a national figure. Say, let's say there are 10 women PhDs in the English department, and that constitutes a certain percentage. And that percentage is compared to the total number of women PhDs in English in the United States over, say, the last 50 years. If the percentage of women in the English department is smaller than the national availability seems to indicate, then that seems to indicate again that our department is underutilizing women.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be minorities. We don't really go back 50 years, do we?
Well, those people from 1920 to 1970, that's the data we're using. After that is done, when it's determined if a department is underutilizing women or minorities and or minorities, the department determines how many vacancies they expect to have in the next year and again in the next 5 years. Then based upon the availability of positions and the availability of women, they set a numerical goal, and that it becomes rather ephemeral at that point, as they what they think they can find. That's the.
Of course, those availability figures, they are a first order determiner, but they are influenced by the number of students who have been admitted and actually have completed degrees in those last 50 years, a number of women, minority students, etc. And so it behooves us also to take a look at our admissions policies and our graduate programs throughout with regard to this.
In other words, one of the real advantages of having specific committees to be looking at a number of things is that it isn't all entirely a matter of the marketplace, but rather access to the kind of training and experience and education you have to have in order to get into the marketplace. However, with some departments, and we used a fairly simple one as an example, that's scarcely a problem. Because English is a field that they many women have been interested in. I don't know about minority figures on that. But what you're basically saying then is that what the department is doing is looking at first at itself to see where it stands in relationship to percentages, then looking at what the numbers of people and the percentages of various kinds of people who have the proper training for this profession, and saying to yourself, what would this department look like if it represented what is really available? Now, in the in some fields, of course, this is much more difficult, and there are fields in which there are very few women or minorities who have interested themselves at all, and you may be starting back in the freshman year or back in the junior high school to interest women, for instance, in engineering. If each department started with where it was, I think we'd all be, of course, much better off. Now, this is somewhat more complicated in universities, of course, than it is in certain other affirmative action areas. If you were doing this in we'll say city employment, then you'd use the immediate vicinity, wouldn't you? How many carpenters are there who are women?
As a matter of fact, we're using some Douglas County statistics for our own goals and timetables.
For things outside
for things
of
like
the
clerical
of the,
and
Right, to the availability of people. But the reason you use the whole United States is that that's where universities recruit from, is the whole United States. Mm-hmm. So essentially you're just asking the very reasonable question of what would this department look like if it were truly representative of the people who qualified to be in it.
That's, yeah.
Now the timetables part you mentioned. We're living in a day when we're not in a growth industry anymore, and so you do have to sort of figure out, you know, when is someone going to retire, when is someone likely to leave to go somewhere else, mm-hmm. and so you set your timetables accordingly, and then you also mention a very important aspect that you're judged on the basis of whether you tried to make your department truly representative of the qualified personnel available to be in it. How do you folks feel, who all of you intimately involved with this, as to what problems exist, or how well we're getting along, any comments that you have concerning the enforcement agencies, who are mainly the HEW, the wage and hour people, the Kansas Commission on Civil Rights. Do you have any comments on where we seem to be going? We are, as Vicki mentioned, we have been investigated by a number of compliance agencies. Any report from them yet?
No, as a matter of fact. We've heard, we had an on-site review by HEW conducted here last winter, and we have not heard as yet any final report from them.
It was a year ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, a year ago. And
the State Commission, Civil Rights Commission, will probably act sooner on
a
charge.
I suspect. Let's see, when was it? In October of last year, in October 1972, a suit was filed with the Kansas Commission on Civil Rights, charging that the university discriminated against female faculty and students. They have since conducted quite an extensive investigation, but we've not heard any report of the results of that investigation.
They're understaffed, and there are many more charges than they can possibly investigate. So I think it's not likely that we can rely on having to comply through order.
Nor should we have to.
Nor should we have to. I think, but we're making some headway, just in the naming of committees. If you'll notice, every once in a while, you're seeing some evidence that we are being represented, both women and minorities, on committees that perhaps would never have been attended to before. There are, every once in a while, breakthroughs, and although it's not going as fast as we'd hope, we are making some progress.
At least there is an awareness, isn't there? And which is, of course, one of the reasons that I ask you people to come to be on this radio program on a feminist perspective. Our particular concern, of course, in this radio broadcast is with women, but we are equally interested, of course, in removing discrimination from anyone who has previously been discriminated against.
As a matter of fact, Dean Taylor, I was speaking with the department chairman this afternoon, who has recently become aware, through activities of affirmative action, the fact that there just simply aren't enough men in a certain area of his department, mm-hmm. and they're going about trying to recruit more men in that particular teaching area.
Yes, that's very important for us to recognize. When we talk about discrimination by sex, we're not talking only about women. They're underrepresented in a great many fields, and we do have some fields in which men are underrepresented, too. They're certainly underrepresented in home economics departments. We don't have one here. Probably in your field, Edith, aren't they? In social welfare,
human development,
and human development.
Office and clerical staff.
Oh yes, certainly as in the secretarial work, they're underrepresented. The whole movement toward equality, of course, applies to everyone, and they are. The particular groups that have been recognized as underutilized in universities on a professional level has been women and minority members. But when we begin to look at the whole picture, we see that there are some places where men are also underrepresented. So we're really working toward the goal of treating everyone as an individual. Is that correct? With and get rid of all of the myths that exist about group characteristics.
Of course, that's the most difficult part
It really is, because these myths are, of course, firmly established in the minds of a great many people who tell us what men are like, what women are like, what blacks are like, what Chicanos are like, what Indians are like. And yet every one of us knows people in those groups that are a bit like the stereotype. We thank you people for joining us tonight to discuss the question of affirmative action. We hope that those of you in the radio audience will join us each Monday night at 7:30 for A Feminist Perspective.